In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about, at this point, what we know about people leaving welfare in the state of Illinois. Back in 1997, a new law came into effect that really changed the way assistance was provided to needy people in the United States. The program that was in place before was known as Aid to Families with Dependent Children, usually referred to by its initials, AFDC. AFDC went away and was replaced by something else with another set of initials, generally referred to as TANF, which stands for Temporary Aid to Needy Families. And one of the basic ideas of this program was that temporary meant temporary, that there would be a limit to how long people could receive benefits, and the hope was that people would not receive benefits forever or even to the maximum, but that they would move from TANF, that they would become employed and self-supporting. And in fact, in the state of Illinois and other places, the welfare rolls did go down. However, the question remains, yes, people left welfare, but how did they do? What sort of jobs did they get? What sort of income level did they have? What sort of difficulties did they encounter in trying to move off welfare? And in fact, if some people didn't succeed and then ended up back on TANF again, why? Why did they do that? Well, in an effort to try to answer these questions here in the state of Illinois, the Department of Human Services in the state got a grant to do research on this. And a study was done involving folks at the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois and also the Institute for Public Affairs at U of I Springfield. And this morning we have on the show one of the researchers of the study. His name is Stephen Anderson. He's professor of social work here at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And we'll talk a little bit about the change and about what they discovered as they tried to answer that question, what happens to people leaving welfare in Illinois. Questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So any point here, if you have questions, you are welcome to call. All we ask callers is people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along and accommodate everybody. But again, anybody's welcome to call. And locally, 333-WILO. We do also have a toll-free line, by the way, if it would be long-distance call for you, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for coming over to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe it would be a good idea just a little bit here at the beginning to talk about the differences between AFDC and TANF. How did things change when we went from one program to the other?
Well, the major change, as you alluded to, one, is that now there's a five-year lifetime time limit on federal receipt of cash assistance. The other change that's notable is that there was much more attention given to people on welfare having to engage either in work or some form of employment and training activity, so that now it's quite rare for someone to be on assistance and not being involved in some type of education or training activity. And the final thing that is probably the most important nationwide is that the program was turned over to the states, so that now basically you have 50 state welfare programs as opposed to one federal program with some variations in rules. So there's a lot of variation in what's going on in the country with regard to implementing the program.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I thought that I would do is simply try to explore the basic questions that you tried to answer in doing this, starting with taking a look at those people who leave TANF and ask this question, well, just I guess in terms of their basic demographics, who are these people?
Well, in Illinois, most of your caseload's in Cook County. So if you look at leavers geographically, you'll see a little over 70% were in Cook County, which largely reflects, the caseload composition. Almost all these cases are single-parent cases. There's a small portion that are two-parent cases, but it's basically a single-mother caseload. People have been on a variety of lengths of time. That's always been the case with welfare. Some people cycle on and off the system very quickly. Some have been on a long time, and then when the new rules kicked in, left who probably wouldn't have left under the old set of circumstances.
Hmm. Well, the question would be, when you take a look at the people who left and then the people who didn't, to try to get some idea about, did the people who left have some advantage, have some important difference that would then lead us to say, you know, are there certain things that we really need to be doing, particularly to try to assist the people who were still in the programs? What really makes the big difference in people's ability to go or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. When we looked at people, we were able to look at leavers over a period of time. So we could see the people who left the caseload early versus who left, 18 months into the program. And what you tended to see is people who were relatively better off educationally and in terms of employment experience were more likely to leave early. And in some ways, that's pretty intuitive. You would expect under a new set of rules that the people who were most able to get off got off early. There are some troubling findings coming out now from other studies and a little bit of research we're doing now where it looks like there's subsets of people. And so, for example, you have a set of people leaving who are relatively skilled and educated, the group I just talked about, but you also have a set who may be worse off than the rest of the caseload. The assumption on that now, and I think this is an area where more research is needed, is that this latter group were people who maybe didn't understand the rules very well, may have had problems in coming to grips with the new system, and were sanctioned off the caseload. So there's somewhat of a mix, but I do think that most people who are looking at this now will say that the caseload who is left on is relatively disadvantaged from an educational and experience standpoint compared to people who left early in the program. Hmm.
And it also seems to be the case that one of the groups that have a tough time, and here knowing this seems to point to a need that we're not addressing very well. One of the groups that seems to have a tough time are single parents. And then in the later parts of the study, when you look at, you ask this question, well, what are some of the difficulties that you faced in trying to go out and get work? The number one things were, I couldn't find somebody to take care of my children. I couldn't find somebody to, I couldn't find quality care for the kids. And then next to that, and again, this is something that I'm sure we can talk some more about, next to that are transportation sorts of difficulties, people getting to where the jobs are. But the number one issue seems to be childcare.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think the one other one you didn't mention would be medical assistance. Right. When we talk to people comparatively in terms of their well-being while they were on welfare versus not on it, the one area that stood out was the ability to get medical care. And the reason for that is only about a third of the people who work get medical care through their jobs. This is a population that tends to get very unstable, low-paying jobs, so you don't tend to get health care with it. Medicaid, you can keep for up to a year after you leave, but that's gonna fade out. Plus, we found that many people didn't get it. So you couple that with the child care problems. I would agree with you, by the way, that when you ask people what's the biggest barrier that you have to work in one way or another, it comes up as child care. And it's a combination of cost, availability, and also meshing of child care with work hours. So we found quite a few people working night shifts, for example, and that daycare centers are daycare centers, and they're not really child care centers in a broader sense where they can respond to different work schedules.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus. We're speaking with Stephen Anderson. He's professor in the School of Social Work at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He was one of several people who were involved in a study of people who left welfare in Illinois. That is, people who were involved in this new program known by its initials TANF, T-A-N-F, which stands for Temporary Aid to Needy Families. And people who left the program and the researchers were trying to answer the question, well, what happened to these people? And further asking basic specific questions like who leaves, why, what are their experiences of employment afterwards, and what are some of the experiences and difficulties that those people face after having left the TANF program. And again, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Let's go on to this next question and talk about why it is that people leave. Some percentage of people leave because they get work and they manage to get to the income level where that means they're out of the program. And some people apparently are pushed out of the program for reasons that to me are a little bit unclear. Let's talk first about how many people actually manage to get a job and exceed the income limits for participating in the program. So for that reason, they transition out.
It would appear from our data that about 60% roughly leave for what we would call employment reasons. And one misconception, by the way, is that people suddenly get a job and then leave. A much more common pattern in Illinois, and probably one of the better aspects of the program, is that people can combine work with welfare. So that when we look at people's earnings in the quarter before they leave welfare, they're really quite similar to what they were in terms of working when they leave. So generally what you see happen is people start working while they're on welfare, then make a little bit more, then exceed the income that's allowable that you just mentioned and become off the system. But usually you're talking somewhere in the 50 to 60% range are leaving for employment reasons.
Mm-hmm. And I gather that one of the differences between Illinois and a number of other states is that the rules are a little bit more generous. That is, Illinois allows you to earn more money and still retain some of the TANF benefit.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you compare Illinois to other states, we'd probably be one of the leaders in terms of how much people can keep before they lose assistance.
Mm-hmm. For those people who are who leave the program because of I don't recall what the exact phrase that's used in the report, non-compliance or non-cooperation,
right.
And it's not real clear to me exactly what that means.
That is a real mix of reasons, and it's important because it represents probably at least a third of the caseload closes for that reason. The most common one is, as I said before, Illinois, like other programs, requires people to engage in some type of a job search, education, some kind of a training program, and closures for non-cooperation are primarily cases where someone doesn't cooperate with that. And I think the real key that we don't understand very well is why they're not cooperating. Is it a good cause reason? Is it a bad program? Or is it the people just don't choose to cooperate? The answer to that makes a lot of difference with regard to how much someone may be sympathetic to them being sanctioned off the caseload. But clearly there's a large portion that falls into that category, and the outcomes for those people tend not to be as good, as you might expect, as for people who leave for employment reasons.
So though you really don't know specifically how many people, let's just say that they're sort of willful non-cooperators, and how many people would be interested in being in the program, but for some reason they're really not able to go along with the rules. They're not sure what exactly is provided for them. It's not that they're intentionally saying, no, I don't want to have anything to do with this. It's that they're having a difficulty making it work for them.
That's right. I mean, and for example, some of the barriers that you mentioned before, like childcare. Perhaps I don't go to a meeting because I have a childcare problem. Now, depending on my relationship with my caseworker and how that's interpreted, I may be sanctioned off the program. There might be another case where I don't have a problem and I just choose not to go. And I think that's one area where we don't understand the real dynamics of that set of circumstances where people are thrown off the casework or thrown off the caseloads as well as we need to.
We have a caller. Others are welcome if you'd like to call in. You have questions, comments for us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. First caller here is locally. Local, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was calling regarding the child care that you brought up, that it isn't available for the various hours that a lot of our jobs have, and we do have a lot of jobs that run a 24-hour shift. three shifts of 8 hours each, and I wondered what you have found or would recommend in the childcare industry towards making this happen so that people would have an opportunity to have proper childcare, whatever shift they were able to get.
Well, I'm not a childcare industry expert, but it's quite clear that many services are not open for these shifts. Now, the Department of Human Services program does allow people to use what we call informal care, relatives, friends, non-licensed care, and still get reimbursements for services. However, of course, that brings up a whole host of other issues related to quality of care. I would like to see centers expand the hours that they're in operation. At least there seems to be some demand for it, but I really haven't studied the extent to, how often centers like that do have extended hours. But that's obviously something that there seems to be a need for this population.
And from a social work point of view, how do you think something like that could happen if children are used to sleeping at night and they would be sleeping away from home, that sort of thing? Or is that not something that you're familiar with?
That's a little outside my area of expertise, I would say.
Well, thank you very much for your consideration.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Again, I guess in an effort to flesh out a little bit more of this, how important this particular issue is, that is access to child care. If you look at those people who leave the program because of quote-unquote non-cooperation, how many of those people are single parents?
Most of them. Most. I mean, when you look at the overall caseload of leavers, over 90% are single parents. So pretty much any way you slice the data according to the reasons they left, most of them will be single parents, the large majority. So I don't know the data off the top of my head, but it's probably going to be over 90% at any rate.
There seem to be some interesting differences between when you look at upstate and downstate, that essentially when you look at people in the Cook County area and people everywhere else in the state of Illinois. What are some of the significant differences in the experiences of the people who live around Chicago in that area and people who live, say, in Champaign-Urbana?
Well, we don't have splits just on Champaign or Urbana, but if you look at Chicago versus downstate, a few things come to mind. First of all, I think relatively speaking, overall, the Chicago Cook County population somewhat more disadvantaged on average than the downstate population. It's not to say that there's not mixes both places, because there are. But, for example, if you look at leavers in Cook County, they're more likely to have been sanctioned off the caseload as opposed to have leaving left for work. They're more likely to be never married or not living with partners. There's a substantial difference between Cook County and downstate in that regard. So the way that tends to play out is they might be less likely to have informal help in circumstances or the help of a partner. The wages tend to be a little bit higher, but I think that reflects the higher cost of living in Chicago. And then the last thing that really is noticeable is that they tend to use support services less. And I think this gets us into an area that a lot of times seems pretty boring, but the more that I've looked at this, I think is important, and that is how these services are administered at the local level, what the interactions are between human service bureaucracies and caseworkers with the clients makes a big difference in service use. So that we looked, for example, at Medicaid, food stamps, child care, and the earned income tax credit, which is income support for people. And we found that people in Cook County were less likely to use those resources. And our major hypotheses about that are that it has a lot to do with how they're administered. In other words, when I leave the caseload, does the worker take the time to tell me, yes, you can get child care through this set of programs, you can get food stamps if your income stays at a certain level, or is it pretty much just a quick cutoff without much interaction. And we found major differences across the state. And in the rural areas, you seem to see people getting supports more often. Now, if you think supports are important in maintaining the stability of people staying off, that becomes important in terms of how you structure the relationships between people when they're leaving to make sure they at least know about what's available.
Mm-hmm. Well, where is the problem? Do you think that it is that caseworkers aren't really giving the information to people, or that people aren't aware that those services are available, or that somehow the way that what you have to go through to get the service is so much of a problem, it's so difficult, it's time consuming, that people are saying, I just can't, it's everything I can do to try to hold down this job I'm doing and take care of my children, and I don't have time to be going to some office someplace and standing in a line and filling out forms.
Actually, you've hit on, and very quickly, you hit on the two things that I think are the most important. We did ask people who didn't receive services why they didn't get them. I've also been involved in another project in conducting focus groups in Chicago with people and asking them about their relationships with caseworkers and whether they get services. And those are the things that really stand out. First of all, you do have a subset of people who just don't need them. I mean, and again, talking when you look at this as a diverse population, there's a subset of people that get off and do pretty well. And perhaps they don't need child care. But of the people who do need them, we had substantial numbers who said, oh, I didn't know I could get that. I wasn't aware of it. And then you had the second group of people, smaller but still important, that said, getting this is a major hassle. Now, again, it becomes somewhat a matter of interpretation. Someone may not be sympathetic to that if it's just kind of the common thing that you or I might have to go through to get any kind of service. But if you start looking at it and you have to go to several different bureaucracies to get different services, you have to interact with a lot of people, it's time-consuming. Again, if you're working the hours, it reminds me of the child care dilemma. If you have to go apply for a service during the day, but that's when you work, it's hard to get in to apply for services, so that there can be a lot of, what we often think of as boring and mundane reasons, but administrative reasons that make it easy or difficult to get the services. So those two things together, lack of knowledge and difficulty in getting the service, both show up quite a bit when we talk to people.
Mm-hmm. I wonder when you look at the differences between upstate and downstate, whether part of the reason that perhaps people downstate are more successful or take advantage of the services has something to do with the fact that the downstate caseload is less, and they're not having to deal with the numbers of people that these same service providers would have to do in Cook County.
I don't know the answer to that. It's something I'm interested in. My suspicion is that even if the caseloads numerically are similar, I think there is a real difference in atmosphere sometimes in offices, and that in Chicago, for example, welfare offices tend to be pretty intense places, secure places in many cases. And I think there is a difference in the administration of the services. Looking at the caseloads would be interesting to see if that's the reason. And the other thing you'd have to look at is the differences in training of the caseworkers in the different areas. One thing that sometimes overlook here is that we have pretty much a major systems change going on, and that can overwhelm caseworkers as well as clients, so that suddenly the way that caseworkers have to deal with clients has changed. They have to know a whole lot of new rules. They have to know about many different programs. And if they're not well-trained and if they're not competent, they may not provide information to people that's useful, even if they're well-meaning. So I'm not trying to imply that caseworkers in one place versus the other deliberately don't tell about services, although sometimes clients think that. It can be a combination of caseload factors, training factors, education factors, and as far as the caseworkers are concerned. Mm-hmm.
We're just about at the midpoint here. Again, our guest in this part of Focus 580, Stephen Anderson. He's professor in the School of Social Work at University of Illinois. We're talking about a study that he was involved in looking at what happens to people leaving welfare in Illinois. our number here in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, the next major area here is employment, and I hope people won't feel like maybe I've buried the lead here, because I suppose to some people this would be the most important issue. You said, if I remember right, that maybe about 60% of people leave for work. When you take a look at the employment experiences of these folks, particularly if you look at the question, how much money are they making, what do you find?
Well, first of all, one thing that we found that I think is kind of contrary to a lot of stereotypes about the welfare population, we looked at people basically up to 18 months after they left welfare. So we at least have some trend data on how they did. People that we interviewed, we talked to about 6 to 8 months after they left. When you talk to people about their employment, just in that first 6 to 8 months after they're leaving, 85% of them had worked at some point or another. So this notion that people aren't working isn't the case. However, the work tends to be inconsistent. So we only had 15% of the people didn't work at all after leaving, but only about 35 to 40% work consistently. So what that shows you is there's a very large middle population, up to near half the caseload, that is kind of in and out of work. So there's a lot of different reasons for that, but one of the major ones is that the jobs tend not to be very stable. They're getting marginal jobs, sometimes temporary jobs, and they turn over quite a bit. As far as wages are concerned, the median wage for people when they left is around $7 an hour. When we interviewed them 8 months later, it had gone up to $7.40. So the good news is there was some wage growth in the early periods after people left. The less good news, or bad news in some people's mind, is that the wage level is still low. So that if you look at people in the first year after welfare, usually we're only finding about a fifth of them had wages that in themselves would be enough to lift people above poverty. So you have a very large portion of the leavers are not making enough to get out of poverty. They may be making a little more than they were on welfare, because welfare pays a very minimal subsistence, but there's still very basic income problems among the people who leave. Mm-hmm. I think that the trick's going to be over time, does this early job experience that people have lead to wage growth that gets people out of poverty? And that's what longer-term studies will tell us. If it doesn't, then in some senses what we've done is still create a working poverty population and expanded that pool of the population. People who don't want to pay taxes to support people will say, oh, that's better than welfare. But if you want to measure well-being of people and economic well-being, it's still not a very satisfactory outcome.
Mm-hmm. Just to underscore something that you said, you talked about the fact that there was this perception that people who receive welfare don't work at all, which is not now the case. But I think that's never really been the case, even with the way the system was before. This perception that people had as well, people receiving welfare didn't work, and that they received benefits for years and years and years and years. But it seems more often the case that there were people who did work, but they had, as you described it, had this very sporadic work history based on their difficulties of finding more stable work, based on maybe the lack of education and lack of work experience. That thing sort of feeds on itself.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I don't want to imply that was the case before. In fact, I really question how much work effort has really gone up under this program, and it's an area that we don't know that much about. But if you look at the pre-TANF program, when people weren't necessarily being forced off the program or forced to report employment in order to keep benefits, some of the best studies that were done found that about half the population who was on welfare was working. Now, if you look at government reports, the number who reported working was much lower than that. And that's because people were not reporting what they were earning, because they needed to combine what they were earning with their welfare benefits basically to make ends meet. What TANF did was it created a powerful reporting incentive. In other words, if I wanted to stay on, I had to show them I was doing something. So now if I'm working, instead of not reporting it, just to keep getting what I received before, I had to report it. What's that do? It pushes up your statistics in terms of the number of people who are working, but it's not really clear that all that was new work as opposed to – so the question is, did we really increase work that much, or did we increase reported work a lot? I haven't seen any good studies that can clearly disentangle that, but the notion that people weren't working before, I think, is something that's very overstated.
You also looked at people who had been off TANF and then had to come back. When you looked at the reasons for that, what did you find?
It's usually employment. I mean, again, and this goes along with what we've been talking about earlier. People leave. They get into jobs that are temporary or unstable. Perhaps they didn't have very good employment experience in some cases and didn't do well on the job, and the job ends. And basically just for short-term survival, they'll go back onto the rolls. There's a smaller segment of the population that goes back for health reasons. And for pregnancy reasons, but it's really predominantly work and money, the reason, inadequate money from the earnings in order to be able to survive that pushes people back. And we found roughly a third of the people go back in the first year. So it's not an insignificant portion of the leavers.
You earlier on when we talked about who it is it that leaves, the first people that managed to get off, managed to leave TANF, are those people that have some kind of work experience and have an educational background so that it makes them eligible for employment. What sort of things for those people who have a more difficult time for the same reason, that is they maybe don't have the education, they don't have the employment experience. What does TANF do to try to help those people? What sort of services are available?
For people without experience?
Yeah.
Well, that's one area that's fairly controversial. In principle, you can have people go into an education component rather than a job search. In other words, if the system's working at its best, a caseworker might take a person with no experience and say, we won't have this person go into work right away. It would be better off to their long-term development to put them in an education or training program. In practice, in this state and in most states, what's been put in place is what's called a work first model, which essentially has people come in and tells them to test the job market before they really get into any other kind of employment and training component. In practice, what that means is sometimes people get thrown into the job market, into unstable jobs, who maybe would be better off going into an education program. So I guess what I would like to see is more of a careful assessment at the front end when somebody comes in to determine whether going into the job market in the short run is really the best approach, as opposed to pushing somebody into jobs. It's quite ironic now that all the studies that are out with regard to globalization of the economy show that education is increasingly important. At the same time that education's being shown to be increasingly important to employment outcomes, we've implemented nationally, for the most part, with a few exceptions, welfare programs that push a work-first model where people with no experience are being thrown into the job market. And to me, that doesn't seem like a very good common sense approach.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that's at the discretion of the caseworker?
Well, it's at the discretion of the state and the way they design the policy. It's true the caseworker always has some discretion, but they're still bounded in some sense by the rules that are in place. So that if the predominant state policy is to say send somebody to work first, then in most cases the caseworker will follow through. What I'm suggesting is that the caseworker in some sense be given more discretion to do an employability assessment that has a range of possibilities associated with it. For someone who comes in and is planning what to do with their lives.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm interested, though. We've sort of talked about this before. When you looked at what are some of the barriers to employment that people face, you would think that work-related experience and education or lack of education would be very, very important. And in fact, they rank much below the other things that we've talked about, that is the child care issue. And that's the number one thing, finding somebody to take care of your children, the difficulty in finding child care at the time that you need it, and simply paying for child care. That's sort of the number one thing. The next thing is the issue of where do I live and where is the job and how do I get there? And it seems that those things really overwhelm the issues of work experience and education. Not to say those things aren't important, but that it interests me that these other things really are much bigger issue, particularly simply the issue of finding somebody to take care of your children mm-hmm. while you're working.
That's a good point. I mean, and that is those questions were asked of people who are off, and they do tend to interpret the support services as most important. I guess my impression is that, and it's kind of interesting part of talking to people, most people really dislike the welfare system and do want to be off the system and doing something. So one thing that kind of surprised me about the study was a fair degree of job satisfaction, even with jobs that you or I might not find overly desirable. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you start framing it to people who have been away from the welfare system, they will say, give me a little more support or give me a little more ability to make income, and I'll make do here. So I think they do focus on that particular issue. One thing that some of the focus groups I've done with people who have gone back, they tend to be more inclined to emphasize the lack of training or the lack of ability to get good jobs. And I think those are people who have gone out and failed. They've seen the jobs not working out, and they come back and say, you know, I don't have enough skill, or I didn't have enough training to get something that lasted. So that set of people tends to be more inclined, I think, to focus on need for further training.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's go to line number four, I think. Chicago? Hello?
Yeah, hi. Uh-huh. I got a million questions to ask, and let me make one statement with regard to this problem, and that is that you can't look at the problem without looking at the general economy and the unemployment rate. And it may be considered separate from the reason why these people are leaving, but those who promoted this program, particularly the former governor of Wisconsin, pointed to the great success that he had, and nothing was taken into account, or the unemployment situation and the employment situation was never mentioned as a contributing factor to what he considers the rate of success. Now, unemployment up in Wisconsin is 2-2.5%. 5-10 years ago, it was probably up around 6-8%, 10%, somewhere in that range. And so these people at the bottom of the ladder had very little chance of getting jobs in the public market. That is a market that is not the underground market. Now, the reasons for leaving, I'm wondering just what the wages were that these people were earning as compared with the aid that they were receiving. One of the factors that enters into this, and you've mentioned this, was, one of the factors that enters into this is that they're subject to income taxes and Social Security taxes, which immediately reduces the amount of earnings that they receive. And this may be a factor in their leaving. The other is that if they leave, they can get jobs, they can work in the underground market where nothing is reported and nobody knows what the devil the situation is. The cost of care, how much does decent care cost and how much were they expected to put out?
Well, why don't we pause just there, because you've raised a number of questions, and I'm interested in having Professor Anderson respond, if you can, to some of those things.
Well, starting out, one thing that I'm glad you raised has to do with the unemployment situation. There's been a lot of talk about TANF being successful because of the numbers of people working. But I think you are right that a lot of the success, so to speak, may not hold if the economy goes into a recession. And this is an area that a lot of people are curious about, but I don't think we know the answers to. But really, TANF was implemented in almost a best-case economic scenario where things were going very well. So, keeping in mind what I mentioned a minute ago about the marginal and unstable nature of a lot of jobs, the question is, if the economy goes south, so to speak, will these people be the first people to be laid off and end up going back on the rolls? And I think a lot of people are fearful of that, and time will tell the extent to which that happens. Another point you make that's important is when we compare how one is doing after they leave to when they're on, you do have to take into account expenses. So, for example, David was talking about child care. If people don't get fully subsidized or don't get subsidized at all, they may be making more money, but they're also paying out more. There are costs that are associated with employment, and that's a very important consideration, and it's why I think the support service issue is so important in making sure people get hooked up with supports they need so that the extra money they're earning doesn't just go to pay for services and that ultimately they're not any better off. I would say that when we ask people if they're better off income-wise than when they're on, most of them say they are better off. But again, keep in mind, they're still not well off in terms of income. And just as an example, we have substantial numbers of people above 30%, above a third, who say they're behind in rent. These are people who have left or who say they've had to skip meals or have food shortages. So there's still quite extreme needs, in my view, in terms of the people who leave the system.
Another area that I'm interested in is the quality of the personnel of the social workers in quotes in the agency or agencies that these people have to contend with. 20 years ago, Governor Thompson was trying to politicize the public aid system. I don't know if he succeeded. I suspect that he did, but I haven't heard anything or seen anything published. I was at that point, 15 years ago, an employee of the state, and I was knocked off working in a different agency because there was politicization going on. Republican party members and so on were being appointed, and those who were in the merit system were being knocked off, and we couldn't get any sort of support from anybody, neither in the newspapers nor in agencies. Now, I don't know if that continued, nor the labor unions as far as that went. The union in public aid was trying to battle this politicization, and they were having a real rough time, and I don't know what happened finally.
We're getting down to, 2-3 minutes. Is that something you can
I really can't comment on how political it is, no.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I just also want to touch on one other thing the caller raised, because he talked about the issue of taxes. I'm struck also by one of the features in the study that you did, looking at people, the services or the benefits that were available, who used them and who didn't. One of the things that people in government also always sort of talk about is something that they have tried to do to address the needs of low-income people is the earned income tax credit. What you found was that while 85% of the people who had left had worked at some time since leaving TANF, only 41% said they received the earned income tax credit, and only 47% had a clear idea of what it was. So obviously here it's something that we say this is here to try to help people, to low-income people, but there are a lot of folks here who have no idea what it is.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of a tragedy in my view. The earned income tax credit, you can get over $3,000 as a tax credit. You don't have to file taxes. And when you take into account these people are maybe earning $8,000 to $10,000 a year, you can see that's a major boost in their income. Mm-hmm. And so the importance of making people aware of this and letting them know that all they have to do is fill out a federal tax form, even if they don't owe taxes, really is important both in terms of just their economic well-being, but from a public policy standpoint, reinforcing benefits of work so that people know that they're getting something back for their labor.
We'll try to get one more caller here in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. It's related to day child care, actually. It seems to me that a child with his or her mother may be in a better developmental situation than one in a minimal care, child care situation. Are we going to produce a generation of children who are developmentally retarded, perhaps less able to deal with life?
Well, I'm not a child development person. I will say that there are a lot of studies going on that are looking at the impact of welfare on children. So, I mean, on welfare reform on children. So they will be looking at, for example, do kids do better when their mother stays home, if it's a welfare-related population, versus when they go to work and the child is put into some form of daycare. But that's really not an area that I know a lot about.
It does seem to be the case, though, interestingly enough, when you look at the history of welfare, that one of the intents when I think AFDC came along was to keep children at home with their families, with their mothers. So that we said, well, it's better off if kids stay at home with mom. She takes care of the kids. We don't want the mom to have to go out and work. So we developed this program that would provide assistance. Now we've completely flipped this over and now have said, no, that's bad. What we want now is people to go out and work. So we have changed the program around. We've changed the intent around completely.
Well, yeah, I think one thing that happened, I mean, if you look over the last 30 years or so, women entered the workforce from all economics spectrums. So you ended up with a situation where many women, middle class or working poor women, were working and were sending their kids to daycare, be it informal or formal, and you still had this other program for poor women where they weren't expected to work and were staying home with their kids. And that whole norm that you talk about has switched, and it became, I think, politically insupportable to have people stay home with their kids when most people in the rest of the society weren't doing it.
We're going to have to stop. My apologies, one other caller we can't take. I'm sure, though, it's an issue that we'll continue to follow. For the moment, we want to say to our guest, Stephen Anderson, professor in the School of Social Work here at U of I, thanks very much.
Thank you.